Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for December 21st, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got two interviews up tonight. In about 10 minutes or so, we'll speak with Ian Williams, who is the author of a book that's not new, but topical because of the season, a book called Rum, A Social and Sociable History of the Real Spirit of 1776, published by Nation Books. A while back, but since this is the holiday season when lots of rum is consumed, I thought it was a perfectly appropriate way to observe the holiday season by giving us the political economy of this very important alcoholic beverage. And since Ian is also a UN correspondent, get a little quick observation out of him on the departure of Kofi Annan and his successor by a man whose name now escapes me. I apologize for that. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll listen to an interview recorded earlier this week with Robin Blackburn, author of a book on how finance is failing. It's all about pensions. The second book by Robin Blackburn on the topic of aging and pensions and the relation to the financial system. That is the bottom of the hour. But before we get there, I will be slipping out at about the bottom of the hour, and the rest of the show will be on recording. So I do want to say make the usual end-of-year observations. I'll forego the temptation of listing the 10 greatest or 10 most dastardly events of 2006. But I do want to second the words that Hugh Hamilton spoke just a few minutes ago in thanking all of you for listening, for supporting the show, for supporting the station throughout the year, and I hope you continue to do so in the next year. And I also want to second Hugh's thanks to Michael G. Haskins, the chief announcer and excellent engineer, whose technical skills and calm demeanor and fine companionship make this show a lot more pleasurable to do. Thank you, Michael, and happy holidays to all of you. I'm kind of a sentimentalist about the holidays. I like them. I like having fun. I like feeling good about family and friends. I like even the exchange of presents. I know the common thing to do is complain about commercialism, but there's a good emotional celebratory core to it that we shouldn't let the merchants monopolize. Let's just maintain the good stuff and ignore the bad stuff as far as we can. And then just a few words about what's been going on in the economic news before we get to the main events of the program. That little boomlet in mortgage demand, I noticed the last few weeks, does seem to be subsiding. The Mortgage Bankers Association reporting an 11% decline in its applications index, led by a 16% decline in refinancing demand. Though the housing boom is history, there's a chance that it may gain a new lease on life if the Federal Reserve continues to leave interest rates unchanged in the coming year. That's what happened in Britain in 2005 and early 2006. They had a ripping housing boom that stumbled in 2004 when the Bank of England started raising interest rates. But when they paused in 2005, housing took off again, as did so-called mortgage equity withdrawal, that is, borrowing money against the value of the house and spending it. That sort of borrowing, which has been fueling the U.S. economy for the last several years, slowed in the second half of the year in the U.S., which has led to a slowdown in retail sales. But the consensus among pundits is that the worst of the housing decline is behind us, and the housing market in 2007 could see a recovery. Maybe. The British example says that's certainly possible, but I don't see how we could experience the most manic housing boom in history, a boom in prices, in new construction, and in turnover of existing houses, and then just see a relatively gentle decline, rather than a bust even bigger than the ones we saw in the mid-70s and the early 90s. I gotta say, though, it's weird to think of furiously rising prices in one of life's essentials, shelter, as good economic news, but that's the funny old world we live in. The Labor Department reported this morning that first-time claims for unemployment insurance, filed by people who just lost their jobs, rose by 9,000 last week after some sharp gyrations around Thanksgiving. It's very difficult to parse those numbers around holidays, so it's best to strip away those distortions and just look at the time before and after. And when we do that, we see a decent but unspectacular job market that's not likely to get much sprightlier in the early part of next year. After a strong rise from September through November, the weekly ABC Washington Post measure of consumer attitudes has been flat for the last several weeks, a fair to middling level. Curiously, while a small majority of people believe that the national economy isn't in good shape, and a slightly larger majority think the buying climate now isn't so great, almost two-thirds say their own personal finances are pretty healthy. Sometimes people tell pollsters that things are okay by them, but things aren't so good in the larger world, and that may be because it's un-American to complain about one's lot in life. So the more general judgments may actually reflect personal anxieties that people feel uncomfortable about expressing directly. In any case, so the economy looks reasonably strong on paper, it doesn't feel so good to most people on the ground. But except Wall Street, our neighbors up and down this storied thoroughfare have had a tremendous year. They're sharing about $24 billion in bonus income among themselves, and not that widely. The State Comptroller's Office estimates that the average bonus will be $137,000, although secretaries will probably get a few thousand bucks, while the CEO of Goldman Sachs is going home with over $50 million. There are about 200,000 people who work in finance in New York City, and their bonus pool is about three-quarters as much as the nearly 2 million people who live in the Bronx pull down in a year. Nice work, if you can get it. And now, let's listen to an excerpt from the Shell Oil Company's company song. This turned up on the Internet recently. It was pointed out by the Financial Times' excellent columnist Lucy Kellaway, who is, among the other things, a chronicler of corporate cant. She at first thought this thing was a parody. It is, as you will shortly hear, set to the tune of We Are the World. And whatever the flaws of that rather flawed song, at least, you know, it had intentions of doing something about, in a solidaristic fashion, to relieve poverty among the poorest people in the world. Here is Shell turning it to a celebration of their own corporate culture. And this is Shell Oil, remember, a company that's been linked with repression in Nigeria, leaving toxic waste all over the place around the world, and perhaps less criminally, but no less notably, lying about the size of their oil reserves. So this is a company that is among the worst of a rather bad lot, but here they are celebrating themselves with this rather strange song called, what is it called? Growing and Winning. Let's listen to about 2 minutes of this thing.
There came a time when we heed a certain call for a change. We need to bond together as one. Now we're on a journey to streamline the way we work and build a global enterprise. We have moved on, growing day by day, sharing strengths. We practice what is best. We are all a part of Shell's global family, doing work aligned with everyone.
We are the best. We are all winners. We are the ones who have made a change. We've grown the business. We are Shell tomorrow. Because we're one great team. With our space vision and strategy, we will succeed. Cause they're part of our team. Hand in hand, we'll build the vision we planned.
Our highest goal is to be the customer's best choice. For the team, we must lend a helping hand.
We are the best. We are the winners. We are the ones who have made the change. We've grown the business.
And that, about 2 minutes of the Shell Oil Company's company song. A really lovely piece of music, isn't it? We've grown the business. They packed more corporate cliches into that two-minute ditty than you would ever think humanly possible. And now we're joined on the line by Ian Williams, who is, aside from his serious work as a UN correspondent, is also a author of a very fine, enjoyable book called Rum, A Social and Sociable History of the Real Spirit of 1776, published by Nation Books. And it's not exactly hot off the presses, but since this is the Christmas season when one consumes an inordinately large quantity of rum, I thought this was a relevant and appropriate time to have Ian on. Welcome to Behind the News, Ian.
Oh, well, the paperback is just out, I'm pleased to say, so it's not quite as untopical as we first thought. And,
well,
I'm glad you explained that previous song, because I was listening. I came in the middle. What's happened to him? What's happened?
Lost my mind. That's really quite something. Actually, the FT's columnist, Lucy Kellaway, discovered that piece of nonsense.
You would have thought that they could have afforded better writers, wouldn't you?
You would think, but it could have been that sort of original music instead of stealing that sad old song from 20 years ago. Well, before we start talking about rum, I do want to talk about what's gone. There's been a change of personnel at the UN, and since your day job is a UN correspondent, what do you make of, first of all, the departure of Kofi Annan?
Well, I mean, it was end of his term, and he went as gracefully as he came, and it's a complete contrast. If you went around the world, lots of people sort of shed tears and said nice things, and the Fox and Murdoch press, and the New York Post and the Daily Sun went out with the same venom and bitterness that they reserved for his last term. You would never guess that this guy was the American nominee for the position, which is why, of course, the new guy coming in, Ban Ki-moon, if I may quote myself, within weeks of him being sworn in, he's going to get sworn at by these people.
Well, yeah, he was, Annan was supposed to be a relief after,
Butrus Ghali,
yeah, as he put it, who was, they expected him to be more secretary and less general.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's one of those things. Kofi is not a sort of heroic figure in some ways, but it's just a peculiar match, a mix-up of virtues that you need for this job. I mean, you've got to be able to state things in a principled way, and yet at the same time not antagonize people so that you can't do your other job, which is to sort of talk to some pretty nasty, vicious people like George Bush or Ariel Sharon or Ahmadinejad. You know, he's got to shake hands with them and make peace afterwards. So it's a sort of peculiar mix of talents, and I think that in many ways Kofi Annan was uniquely suited to it, because he did say things so quietly that, I mean, if anything, the biggest accusation is that sometimes he would say things so quietly that, you know, why say them if you're not going to get up people's nostrils? You know, why did it take him so long to sort of get badgered out into public about saying the Iraq war was illegal? And mostly that was because the press never asked him until a BBC correspondent came on. Now, most American correspondents were just so self-satisfied with what Washington told them that they would never dream of asking a question, a subversive question like that.
And what can you say about the new guy, Ban Ki-moon, is that his name?
Well, I've actually got some. I mean, it's early days, and I'm a perennial optimist. I mean, God knows I've been on the left for all of my life, so you've got to be optimistic by temperament, haven't you? And he has. I'm impressed because South Korea, for five years that he was foreign minister, had a more independent foreign policy than Tony Blair could manage. And Tony Blair didn't have a nuclear-armed George Galloway in Scotland sort of as an excuse for doing what the Americans told him. But the South Koreans, they've disagreed with Washington in significant ways, as much as they can for a country that's almost completely dependent on, you know, the American weaponry to stop them being invaded from the north.
All right, so let's move on to rum. On the surface of it, a more pleasing topic, but it does have a rather bloody and ugly history in a lot of ways, doesn't it?
Well, it is. It's the foundation of the modern world, and the modern world was built on bones and blood. I mean, that's how I started writing it, when I realized that. I sort of had this revelation on my beachside cafe in the Caribbean with a large glass of rum in my hand, that the Caribbean was the Persian Gulf of the 18th century. This was where hundreds of thousands of people from all over the world came to die to make sure that rum and sugar moved on their stately way northwards around the Atlantic. And, you know, there was people, there were soldiers from France and Britain and Holland and Spain, and they went and died there in their tens of thousands. And of course, untold millions of slaves were brought over from Africa for the same purpose.
Now, this was the early days of New World slavery, right?
And that's what, the more I got into this subject, much as, you know, I drank a lot of rum as part of the research, but I must say, more than was strictly necessary for the book. But it's the fact that the North America, for better or worse, and the whole modern economic and social system, owes a lot more to the Caribbean than people recognize it. I mean, what we see as the southern slave system was built in the Caribbean. It was Barbados in the English-speaking world, which was the first to distinguish between indentured servants who had legal rights and you know, were supposed to be freed at the end of a term of service, and slaves, African slaves in perpetuity. It was Barbados, the first British colony in the Caribbean, which really passed the first black code and said that, you know, Africans are particularly benighted and deserve perpetual slavery.
And this was, and what they were put to work at was growing sugar, right?
Well, that was what really transformed it. The first settlements in Barbados, the workforce was white. They were sort of dragooned off the streets of London, or they were prisoners from the English Civil Wars, Scots and Irish prisoners. And well, the more you read about it, once again, Barbados actually defied Oliver Cromwell and signed a peace treaty with Parliament in which the phrase "no taxation without representation" was part of the deal. This might sound familiar to us. The head of the local legislatures in these Caribbean colonies was called the president. George Washington spent a lot of time in Barbados. He was actually considering moving there at one point. And just to show that those sort of these were equal opportunities, evil swine, in 1645, I think it was, it's in the book, there was a white laborers' rebellion, which was put down, with 25 of them being hanged in Barbados. But it was only after that that they began to really become totally reliant on black African slaves being brought in, because they had these problems that they couldn't keep the white guys back down on the farm once their indentures were out. They wanted to get out of there. Every ship that pulled into Barbados, they had big problems with stowaways trying to get out of it and to other places. And a lot of them came to the Carolinas and even up to New England. Most of the governors, early governors of Massachusetts, were related to Barbados in one way or another.
Who got the idea of turning sugarcane into rum?
Well, my hypothesis is that some of these Celtic prisoners of war, the Scots and the Irish, with a fine tradition of distilling, had looked and saw what happened when... You have to remember that when you make sugar, the brown stuff that drips off when you've crystallized the white sugar out is molasses, and there's not that much you can do with it. But if you put water in the tropical heat with yeast, it starts fermenting right away. But the people who tried this experiment tell me that it's an experiment you only try once, because it carries on fermenting in your stomach. So I suspect that one of these Irish or Scottish prisoners was looking at this stuff bubbling away, and he thought, I know how to get the good stuff out of that. And bingo, you have rum. And 1 gallon of molasses makes 1 gallon of pretty potent rum. It was the most sort of best, the fastest feedstock you can imagine for mood-altering substances in a liquid form.
And I gather this was a higher value-added way of processing sugar than just granulated powdered stuff.
Well, the economics, it gave the British an advantage. Even though the British weren't particularly good at growing sugar compared to the French weren't allowed to make rum because it would compete with cognac back home. But the English Caribbean colonies, they made the rum, and the sale of the rum paid for all of the local costs of running the plantation, which meant that when the sugar landed in Britain, that was pure profit for the absentee owners. And that had consequences, because that money was what was basically used and invested in government bonds. You know, Britain picked up from the Dutch, but really pioneered the use of the national debt as a weapon of war. The reason the British could keep fleets and armies going all year round, unlike the French, who had to send them home for harvest, was because the government could borrow money. It could write checks right away for huge numbers of ships and arms and to buy allies as well. You know, whenever they were short of men, they would buy the Prussians to go and attack the French or something like that.
And so it spread from Barbados throughout the Caribbean then over there.
Yeah, the next big refinement was in Jamaica, where they decided if you distilled it twice, you were going to have less of a bad head the following day. And all the other islands picked up in different ways. But the main discovery was an accidental one, because rum, more than any other spirit, it really matures well in a wooden cask. And to begin with, it was like Madeira. They used to ship it around on long sea voyages, thinking it was the sea air that improved it. And, of course, it was because they stored it in oak casks. And all of this alchemy of long molecules breaking down and oxidation coming in through the wood and some of the flavor of the wood and the oak coming out, that's what produced the fine premium rums that some of us enjoy and savor at times like this.
And I was speaking with Ian Williams, author of the book Rum, A Social and Sociable History of the Real Spirit of 1776, from Nation Books, just out in paperback. So it is more timely than I thought when I started this, because your publicist only sent over the hardcover, so I wasn't quite aware.
Hey, you're honored. They're honored. They're going to be precious collector's items, too.
This is a substance that's intimately associated with the British Navy. Of course, there's that famous phrase of Winston Churchill's, the great traditions of the British Navy, rum, buggery, and the lash. Why is it so closely associated with the British Navy?
Well, the British started off with, they used to give a beer ration. The thing was, nobody wanted to drink water. You have to remember that until the modern age, water was a toxic substance. It was filled with bacteria. People died from drinking water. And the whole point about beer was that the yeast killed the bacteria and kept them out, and same with wine. So they drank alcoholic drinks as a health measure. And what happened in the Caribbean was, when they got this stuff, it was Samuel Pepys was the first to authorize an experiment with the use of rum for the Navy. And then Admiral Vernon, after whom Mount Vernon is named, he was the one who sort of made it a definitive issue of rum for every rating. And it was a pint of neat overproof rum every day, which was... It's stunning, really, that the Royal Navy ever left port, let alone that it won battles. I mean, that they did. He did also sort of introduce the idea that it had to be served in two servings and diluted, which was not always very popular. But, obviously too many people had fallen off the yardarm when he did it. That carried on until the 1970s in Britain. During the Civil War, when all the Southern sailors left the U.S. Navy, that was when Prohibition was basically introduced into the American Navy. It was along with abolitionism, we forget, is Prohibitionism. There were two strong currents of the Northeastern evangelists.
Yeah, there is that other, speaking of famous phrases involving rum, there's also the rum, Romanism, and rebellion from American political history. What was that all about?
Well, it was because it all rhymed alliterated in a rhotic way. But the idea, this was straight from that period, your New England Yankees, who had up till then regarded rum as a goodly creature of God. The Puritans drank a lot. They began to look on strong liquor as sort of a terrible thing. And part of that was because of the connection to slavery. You know, people actually boycotted rum and sugar because of the slavery connection. And... But the prohibitionism and the abolitionism marched hand in hand, and of course their opponents tended to be Democrats and Irish and drinkers, and tended to favor the South during the Civil War. So you got rum, Romanism, and rebellion, and it rhymed, even though by then the tipple of choice once you're away from the East Coast was more likely to be whiskey.
And another politically fraught thing involving rum is there's a dispute between Bacardi and Cuba. What was that all about?
Well, it's a little-known fact, and I don't think either side advertises it too much, that the Bacardi family actually sent checks to Fidel Castro when he was up in the Sierra Maestra to maintain the rebellion. They didn't like Batista. And, in fact, the first trade delegation from Cuba, from Castro's Cuba to the U.S., actually had two Bacardi family members as part of the delegation. And then Fidel went and nationalized Bacardi, and they were very, very unhappy. And it's been a serious grudge fight ever since. It didn't affect Bacardi too much, because Bacardi is interesting. It's one of the first transnational corporations in the world. In the 50s, it had already moved its official headquarters to the Bahamas, so it got British Empire preferences, and it had also opened up, after a lot of litigation and buying of legislators, had opened up its biggest distillery in Puerto Rico, ready for the American market to open after Prohibition. So it was already sort of pretty much offshored, and it was Cuban in name only. But as I said, they've had a serious grudge fight for 50 years, and they've used their control of legislators, particularly from Florida, to sort of basically break international copyright law, so that Bacardi is now claiming ownership of the Havana Club trademark.
Which, as you point out, is a decision not recognized by the WTO, but
it's not recognized by anyone anywhere. I mean, it's just the Europeans are scared of the American giant because it's in with conjunction with Pernod Ricard, who flogs the Havana Club rum. I must say, it's also amusing to note that Fidel Castro, a longtime smoker and rum drinker, decided at the height of the austerity to say that Cubans shouldn't drink rum. It was bad for them. It was terrible. But he was less concerned for their health than the fact they were actually running out of rum to sell to the European market, where people like drinking Havana Club rums because it's a way of cocking a snoot at Uncle Sam.
All right, enough politics. Tell us about what's the good rum in the world these days?
There are so many, and each time I list them, I get Caribbean friends calling up and asking me why I failed. So I'll pick on the weakest first. My favorite rum is the one from Haiti, Rum Barbancourt, 15-year-old special estate reserve. It's an exquisite sipping rum, but there's from the Spanish Main, you have Ron's de Capa from Guatemala, 23-year-old, which I got a bottle of for a wedding present a few years ago, in fact. And then there's several from Venezuela. One of them there was called Diplomatico. I asked whether they wanted to call it Undiplomatico after Chavez Ralas' speech, but they're sticking with the name. But then there's the rums from the islands themselves. I mean, Mount Gay Extra Old, Appleton's, Angostura's. The older rums there are sort of pretty good sort of equivalent of blends. El Dorado 15 and 23-year-old, 21-year-old from Guyana is winning a lot of medals nowadays as well. But when you say what's your favorite rum, it depends, you know, what mood are you in, what's the weather like, what's available, how thirsty are you. There's a lot of complex issues at stake here. Just drink them all.
Well, you must have had, this must have been a very tough project to research.
It was, you know, 8 years of intensive on-site, hands-on research across the Caribbean and other places. I mean, you know, in honor of Borat, I've actually got a bottle of Kazakh rum here.
So it's made elsewhere around the world besides...
Yes. Two biggest brands after Bacardi are, in fact, from the Philippines, Tanduay, and the Indian rum, Old Monk. Indians swear by Old Monk. They swear it doesn't give them a hangover, but then they've also told me that no bacteria have ever been found in the Ganges. I must say, I told them it's because of the chemical pollution from the factories that killed them all, if that were the case.
And what about Bacardi? It's a big name, but is it worth drinking?
Actually, most serious rum connoisseurs just don't rate Bacardi at all. I mean, some of this is sort of snobbishness because Bacardi's worked very hard. It does have shades of the evil empire. It does try to keep out all of the other rums and competition. And I think the proprietor of Rum Barbancourt from Haiti put it best in a lovely French Haitian accent. He said, you know, Ian, Bacardi is very, very clever. They always want you to drink their rum mixed with something else. Which is one of the subtlest put-downs I've heard.
Just like, you don't want to drink your bourbon with branch water, if it's good bourbon at all, either.
Yep.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Ian Williams. I've been speaking with Ian Williams, author of Rum, A Social and Sociable History of the Real Spirit of 1776, just out in paperback now from Nation Books, and a fine, entertaining, and informative read it is, but also a window into a very grim history of the early days of rum and its connection to slavery in the Western Hemisphere. So, let's take a break for station ID, and we'll be back in a moment.
Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WVAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York. Enjoy.
This is WBAI, 99.5 FM on your radio dial, and also on the web at WBAI.org, where you can listen to us live streaming, as well as archives of the last couple of weeks of programs, so please do check it out. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News, and we'll be back with Robin Blackburn after this musical break. That was variation number 26 out of 33 by Beethoven on a theme by Diabelli, performed by Maurizio Pollini. And now an interview I recorded a couple of days ago with the sociologist and economic historian Robin Blackburn. Robin teaches part of the year at the University of Essex in Britain and part of the year at the New School here in New York. He was the editor of New Left Review from 1981 to 1999 and has been part of the editorial board of that journal since 1962. He is the author of several books, including The Making of New World Slavery, published in 1997, and The Overthrow of New World Slavery, published in 1988. His most recent interest is the aging society and the problem of pensions. The first symptom of that interest was Banking on Death, published in 2002, and now Age Shock, How Finance is Failing Us, just out from Verso. Robin Blackburn. Robin, pensions are a topic that some people find incredibly dull. How do you transcend the drooping eyelids effect?
Well, I think that they deliberately construct pensions to be pretty forbidding because they don't want you to take too close an interest into what is happening. So it's made very abstruse and arcane, and even people who work in the financial sector find them pretty difficult to understand. However, I think increasing numbers of people, I'm talking millions, even tens of millions, are now getting very upset and angry because there's been a bonfire of pension entitlements. People have been contributing for 20, 30 years, and they're finding themselves left, if not without a pension at all, but at least with something very much less than they'd hoped.
How does someone like you, who has a quite distinguished reputation as a historian of slavery, get interested in the question of pensions?
I think I got interested in it partly because it seemed to me quite important in the overall structure of capitalism. I mean, I was an economic historian, and as one turned to look at the contemporary form of capitalism, you saw that institutional investors were playing an increasingly large role in the total scene. And of course, as I studied it, I realized that actually employees were not benefiting to nearly the extent that I originally thought, that actually the even their total share of all owning of corporate securities is, total pension fund share is about 20%. So it's not as vast as some people think. However, it does mean that tens of millions of working people do have some stake in the workings of the financial system.
People are probably familiar with the Social Security crisis. The pension problem is usually presented as a difficulty of the public system, but the private system, at least in the United States, is hardly in the pink of health, is it?
That is absolutely true. Of course, with the public system, which is a very efficient system, there is a mandated requirement on the trustees to come up with estimates of what the future holds. Actually, the future for Social Security looks pretty good, and it looks as if it's going to be able to pay out something like 5% of the total US GDP in 30 years' time, and it's going to, in that way, really be a major boon for what will be an aging society. It's projected there'll be about 70 million people over 65 by 2035, compared with only 34 million today, so that's a doubling. But no, we don't have similar estimates for the private system, for occupational pension schemes, and also for the so-called defined contribution systems, which are the alternative to the occupational defined benefit schemes.
We should do a little definition here, defined benefit versus defined contribution.
The defined benefit schemes are the traditional occupation scheme where your future pension is specified as a proportion of your final salary or the best years of your working life and the amount of service you've had with a particular corporation. There's been a big switch from those, which gave some reliability and predictability to the pension, to a defined contribution system, which really is a bit of a play on words. It means what's defined is what you put into the saving scheme. What is not at all defined is what you get out of it, which is going to be affected by market risk and, just as important, by high charges from the financial services industry.
Hey, let's go back to, for a moment, to the defined benefit system. A lot of companies have terminated these in recent years, so people thought they were going to have something and don't now, right?
This is indeed the case. There used to be about 45 million U.S. employees in active defined benefit schemes. There are only 17 million at the present time. These used to be good, partly because, as I say, they're more predictable. Also, employers put much more money into them. They used to put 10, 12, 15% of salary. Whereas when they close these schemes or freeze them, the employees are left with schemes. The employers very often put in no more than about 3% into these schemes, and they're eroded by high charges, and of course they're exposed to market risk.
And how often have corporations used their pension funds as piggy banks they could play with?
That has been extremely common, especially in the 80s and 90s. They, for example, used the fact that there was increasing values in the stock market they put that straight to the bottom line and were able to show it often as profit for the company. And even worse, they used it as an excuse not to make regular contributions, as they should have done, to those schemes. So although theoretically they were contributing 15% of salary, sometimes they skip that contribution. And that's now become a major underfunding problem with pensions, these private sector defined benefit occupational schemes. At the present time, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is the sort of public insurance body for these schemes, it says that they're underfunded. This is their last November report. To the extent of $350 billion. That's a very serious underfunding.
Which is roughly what the Social Security system pays out in a given year, I believe. We don't have that much experience with defined contribution programs, but we did get a foretaste of what they might look like in the future when Enron collapsed. But what do you think awaits the so-called beneficiaries of these kinds of schemes?
Yes, the most common type of scheme in the United States here is the 401k. Type of saving scheme, and basically that from all that we know about at the moment, these don't seem to be at all efficient savings vehicles. There is built into them a massive subsidy to the financial services industry, because it's an incentive. You can get tax relief by putting your money into these schemes. But as much as you gain from the tax release, you lose in high charges. Charges that relate to marketing expenditure. There's a big marketing spend on these products. Charges that relate to customizing everything to an individual. That's much more expensive than what Social Security is doing, which is just treating everybody the same and automatically deducting a set amount.
And, of course, then there are the fees for the portfolio managers. Something has to pay for those Porsches and the houses in Greenwich.
That is absolutely true. And it's interesting that someone like John Bogle, who actually was the founder of Vanguard, he, in his recent book, The Battle for the Soul of American Capitalism, he says that these charges are quite extraordinary and that they account for something like between 1.5% and 2% of U.S. GDP.
Which is larger than the projected Social Security shortfall 50 years ahead of us, so this is a large sum of money. I'm speaking with Robin Blackburn, author of Age Shock, How Finance is Failing Us, just out from Verso. underlying the concerns about the future of both public and private pension system is the idea that the society is aging, that the younger cohorts are not as large, that they're entering the labor force are not as large as the baby boom generation, which is now beginning to retire. So there's going to be a real cash flow problem funding pensions, regardless of whether they're public or private. How bad, in your estimation, is this problem, and what's the fundamental approach for dealing with it?
I would say it's a sort of medium-sized problem. I think that there is a problem there of the different size of those cohorts, but I think it's through certain fairly simple measures it would be quite easy to anticipate and meet this problem. It would be possible to fix the problem in Social Security, for example, by raising the threshold below which Social Security is paid by employees. At the moment, there's a cutoff at around $90,000. If that was lifted or abolished and people paid right the way up, all the financial problems of Social Security would be fixed. However, I would say, Doug, that my own view is that Social Security by itself is not enough for a comfortable retirement, and it's not enough for a sort of creative retirement too, and many people will be looking to be quite active once they've retired from their lifetime occupation. They'll be keen to get involved and to keep busy and active if they can, but they will need a reasonable income to do that, probably much lower than they've received during their lifetime, but something like 50%, 60%, or 70% of what they previously were earning.
What about raising the retirement age? When the age 65, which is now creeping up to 67, got set, people didn't really live that long very often. And even if they did live that long, they didn't live much longer than that. Now, of course, it's not uncommon for people to live into their 90s. So you might, instead of retirement of 5 or 10 years, we're now talking about retirements of 20 or 30 years. Does it seem fair to you to talk about raising the retirement age, or is that just something you don't want to contemplate?
I think raising the retirement age is a trap and a mistake. I think it's the sort of work till you drop philosophy. That doesn't mean that I think even the word retirement is really any longer suitable. I think people are going to be fitter in their old age. Something like 80% of 80-year-olds are actually reasonably fit. However, being fitter if you're an 80-year-old is different from being fit if you're a 40-year-old. And there's, I think people over the age of 65 or 67, I think that they should be given the opportunity of being able to draw that pension if they want. And very often that will help keep them active in the community. I would also point out that if we look at those under the age of 65, we find that there's really quite considerable unemployment, and that doesn't always show up in the official unemployment figures. Roughly something like a third of those between 55 and 65 are unemployed at the moment, but even that figure doesn't, for example, those who are on disability pensions are, you know, regarded as not part of the potential labour force. Now the number with disability pensions here in the United States has gone up from 3 million in 1990 to 6.5 million today in 2006. And that's a more than doubling. And really, I don't think the health of these potential workers has deteriorated that much. I think it's much more that their doctors are willing to give them a certificate to say, yes, you're disabled. The real problem is there is discrimination against the older employee. And I would say the first task should be to ensure that all who want a job under the age of 67 have the possibility of getting one. I don't think it's at all of a good idea to raise that retirement age. All the retirement age means is that if you want to, you can retire at that age. If you want to go on working, and of course many employees do, and other workers too, self-employed and so forth, then by all means they should do that. But they should be able to draw a portion of their pension too.
Phrase I first heard in the 80s, spend your golden years under the golden arches, but that doesn't seem like a very attractive social policy. So if Social Security is not enough, what do you see as an ideal supplement to the public Social Security system?
I think we ought to have a second pension, public pension, paid to everybody, but with perhaps, you know, it could be organized in a different way from the Social Security to provide a degree of insurance and diversification in retirement provision. And I think that the idea which most intrigues me is to find some new way of financing it, some new type of tax. One of the big problems in the United States today and in Britain, where I come from, is that the wealthy and the corporations, they're escaping tax on a really huge scale. Here in the US, the IRS just says that there was a discrepancy of $200 billion between what corporations claimed as profit and what later, when they filed for the IRS, they claim as profit. So if they're talking to potential investors, they talk it up, and suddenly it evaporates when they submit their returns to the IRS. So how could one tap into this corporate wealth and shareholding wealth? I think an intriguing idea is that of Rudolf Meidner, the architect of the Swedish welfare state. It's that of a share levy. You ask all corporations, you require indeed all corporations, to issue 10% of their profits each year as new corporate stock, which they give free of charge, of course, to a network of regional social funds that could be, for example, organized by the trust fund in each state here in the United States. And those funds are not to sell these shares at all, but simply to hold them for income and to provide the basis for a second public pension for everybody.
I'm speaking with Robin Blackburn, author of Age Shock, How Finance is Failing Us, just out from Verso. Well, if they can't sell it, then they have a hard time raising cash. Dividends in the United States are only about 3% of GDP, so even if this public system got a fraction of that, that would barely supplement the Social Security system. So how could this set of entity raise cash?
Well, in my book, Age Shock, what I calculate is that for a 27-year period, they would actually reinvest all the income, all the dividends that come from the share network, that come into the share, the network of social funds from the share levy. And I'm able to show there that it would raise, it would accumulate to a value of something like $10 trillion by 2035. That's when the aging effect is going to be quite considerable. Actually, I calculate that the revenue should by that time be about 2% of GDP. So I think you're quite right. I don't think it's going to solve all the problems of the aging society. But it's something that you can apply to pensions that doesn't work. It's about sort of income tomorrow, as it were, or income in 30 years' time. And I think that current tax resources should be put to other things like abolishing tuition fees for college students or properly funding the healthcare system, introducing a national health insurance or healthcare system, or for example, investing against the very heavy costs that will be imposed by climate change. Lots of things we can spend money on, but I think as far as future resources are concerned, it's necessary to anticipate there is going to be a shortfall in about 30 years' time, and there is a way of anticipating that shortfall and providing a state second pension to everybody that will, it's quite true, not be worth more than about 2% of GDP, but that still will be very welcome at the time.
And how would these shares be voted? Would they be voted in the public interest, not voted at all, or voted in accordance with management?
I would very much hope that they would be voted in the public interest, that there should be an elected accountable procedure for the choice of the people on the funds. There is the advantage that this doesn't take away from the resources that enterprises need to invest in jobs and invest in new equipment. It's actually, what it's doing is diluting the value of shareholding and diverting some of the dividends from existing people who own shares to the new network of social funds. And as I'm sure I don't really need to remind you, Doug, shareholding is its ownership is very concentrated. The top 1%, the richest 1% of US households own a half of all corporate securities. So this is a very egalitarian measure. What you're doing is diluting by a little less than 1% a year the value of these shareholdings and transmitting it, and the future stream of income and the present voting rights to a network of accountable social funds.
Now, although the mechanisms of this may seem arcane, it actually is a form of expropriation of the means of production. And the capitalist class would understand this very clearly and would fight it to the death. This is a very large political nut to crack, you would have to admit.
I do, and I think that's the major objection to the scheme. And I think the fact that large numbers of Americans who own tiny amounts of shares think that one day they'll be millionaires or billionaires, I think that's a problem, and you'd have to confront it head on. Certainly people would have to feel that there's, you know, really strong reason for establishing a scheme of this sort. I think that there should be compensation so that genuine pension funds get a rebate, and so that they don't actually suffer dilution of the value of the shares that they hold. So there'd be a number of the details of the scheme would have to be thought through. I also think that the network of social funds should have its own professional staff, and I think it should act to some extent as a champion, well, first of the taxpayer. You know, it should be able to monitor what corporations are doing and opposing and their tax avoidance schemes. I also think that it should be standing up for the smaller investor. That's something that they could do if they have their own expert staff and if they have shareholdings, which they will in every U.S. corporation.
The scheme, which is closely related to the wage earner fund plan in Sweden, it failed in Sweden for any number of reasons. Well, why do you think it crashed in Sweden, and how could we make it work somewhere else in a more hostile political environment than Sweden?
Yes, I think that's something we should study closely. And in Age Shock, I do try and give an account of how the wage earner funds did work. They were set up in 1982, and then they were finally wound up about 10 years later by an incoming conservative government. In a way, they were wound up not because they were failing, but because they were succeeding. They owned 7% of the stock market, and it's true that it wasn't as democratic the form of governance of the funds as I would like to see or Rudolf Meidner had originally envisaged, but still it was a public fund, and this caused great anxiety amongst the business class in Sweden and the conservatives, and they refused to renew the legislation for the scheme in 1992. And certainly I think it would be necessary to build up popular understanding of the working of the scheme. But I do think that we now live in a financial environment that actually suffers much graver problems than Sweden did back then in the 1980s when Meidner came up with the scheme. We have a worse problem of aging society. We have a worse problem of shortfalls in social expenditure. And also, I think we have a more corrupt financial system. I mean, there were problems in the Swedish financial system, but nothing like today with the backdated options. Just recently, we've learnt from a Harvard study that 1,400 directors of large US corporations, 200 of them, were manipulating the stock option schemes that are meant to ally the interests of directors with the interests of shareholders. They were actually making sure that the options were dated to the period when the quotation on the stock was at its lowest level. So this study comes on top of all the Spitzer-related revelations about the way large insurance concerns were gaming their customers, or the mutual funds were gaming their customers. So I think that there's something deeply corrupt, and there's a degree of insider abuse really in today's financial system. And so to try and think in terms of getting new public accountable transactors, I think that's at least a small contribution towards tightening things up.
We've been speaking almost entirely of the United States, but just in conclusion, how does our problem of an aging society and making proper pension provision for it compare with, say, Western Europe and Japan?
The purely demographic challenge is, in fact, much less here in the United States. I mean, I did say that the over 65s are going to go up from 34 to 70 million by 2035. But as a proportion of the total population, the rise is from 12% of the total population today to 20% of the total population by 2035. So because the overall population is rising, the aging problem is a little less severe here, for example, than in Japan, where the population is already declining and where the average age is going up even more sharply than here. And Europe is somewhere between Japan and the United States. So it's not, I mean, it's a real problem, but it's not an absolutely huge problem. It can be easily dealt with. I certainly don't like people who, you know, try to induce panic about this problem. And the very last thing that should be done is to put more of an accent on commercially provided pension products. These are extremely costly and inefficient and risky. So the more of a problem we face, the more we should look for public solutions. I think that society faces other, probably larger problems and risks. Climate change would be certainly one of them. And I think the general increase in poverty and in the world as a whole, I think that that's a huge problem that we should be addressing. But I would say if we could devise a responsible pension system, if we could give it some economic clout, if we had an informed network of social funds, I think we'd be in a better position also to tackle some of these other issues.
And that was Robin Blackburn, the former editor of New Left Review and author of Age Shock, How Finance is Failing Us, from Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. Let's go out with our usual proto-weekend rollick, this time a freshly released remix mashup, Another One Bites the Dust by Queen versus the Miami Project, remixed by the Soul Avengers. Till next week, goodbye and merry holidays.
Comes ready.